who I didn't even know. Now, whether or not the problem was within the dental supplier or the medical supplier, I don't know. But somewhere along the line, she was told this was gold, and it was not. And it had high nickel. She's a very sensitive soul, and it had very bad reactions to a number of procedures. That's going back to the video. In it, you'll see if it's shared, and it's really okay to share it. I did it. It's a home video. I apologize for the lack of professionalism.
No, it was very good.
But I had fun doing it. My wife, pardon?
It had a very good allowed for very good understanding for a layperson just to look.
Oh, good.
Because
thank you.
You took the tooth from manufacturer into placement, and I felt that was very informative.
It's the possibilities are quite revolutionary, I think, and the understanding of dentistry, because usually when we do bridges, going back to the procedure, as you see it, and if Dr. Overholt sees it and says that it would be appropriate and Commander says it's appropriate, you're more than welcome to see it. And the paper I sent along explains it from a technical aspect, but it has also photographs of models showing how the process is done. And then also some, I believe I sent you the photographs also, the person, the end result.
Yes.
Which really is remarkable to me. I mean, I was blown away by these procedures. I just kept playing with it, experimenting. And knowing that endodontically treated teeth are not healthy for the body and removing those, and then the difficulty we approach in our profession is to replace front teeth that are missing at times or other teeth that are crunchers and need to be used for being able to digest and masticate spelt and other products that are really healthy for your body. And if you don't have good crunchers, sometimes you don't get the nutrients or the proper grinding process before it goes down into the rest of the gastrointestinal system to be processed. But so the process is simply one in which you adhere this new material, composite. And I didn't think it up. It's been around for a good number of years. It just wasn't applied this way. But I had to figure out a couple of other procedures to do in order to get it done properly. And it can be done efficiently, effectively, long range. I can't say I've done thousands of them or hundreds of them, but enough of them to be confident. And if you looked at the specifications of the material, it's a very strong process. And I had also, one of the papers will be published in one of the dental journals, Dentistry Today. At least they told me that last October. We'll see. You know, oftentimes they'll say that they'll do things, and then for various reasons, after they've reviewed it again, it's too new or it's too overwhelming so that they'll jettison it. But I'm trusting that they will do that. So the process is simple. I'd also thought of that, you know, the patent, I'm applying for a patent. Actually, I've patented it in common law. I did my own thinking on this, and I don't know if it's good old thinking or whatever, but I patented it. And in a sense, I went to the law books and I looked at the common law patent process, common law trademark, common this kind of thinking. And if you go into patents or in common law patenting, you can see that when you can do this yourself just by saying it. I declare a patent upon it. And so I did do that. Now, I doubt if the courts will recognize that, so I then thought somebody encouraged me to go to the process of going to the regular patent office. And I've now gone through a certain number of steps to get a patent on it, and the process, simply the process. And the purpose of that, too, was to honor Creator God for allowing me to see something, then to use that resource as available for the work that we're doing together in various regards. I don't know how that would come out, but that was the intent. And then And then I also thought the more I share this with people, the more possibilities there are that people, you know, to develop a company, for example, a kit that could be provided for the dental profession, a very simple kit that would have all the elements present. It's kind of like Legos, building Legos or Tinker Toys, and with a video properly applied. And this could be done without going to the major corporations. Like I actually wrote two documents or two letters to the Kalk Company, which is out of Delaware, and did not receive an acknowledgement of either letter, but I used their materials, and I thought that they might be interested in developing some type of a kit out of this kind of thinking, and apparently not. So I'm thinking that if that's so, you know, I just keep moving in the direction that the openings occur. And anyway, this is something that really you should be demanding from your dental surgeon or dentist. Is the composite materials. You no longer have to use metals. if the person is competent and properly trained, he can replace those or put in new restorations or new replacements of teeth without having to use metals. And so far, I believe this material is the most biocompatible that we have available. And that's the main intent, is to first do no harm, to not corrupt the mouth, to not allow your body to receive materials that are contrary to its normal balance.
Would you care to know what the most corruptive thing is to the human mouth?
I would, yes.
The tongue.
The tongue. I hope I haven't violated that. I'm sure I have. No. Yes, that's very good. I have to remember that one.
Commander?
Yes.
I'd like to add something to what Ron just talked about. He inadvertently is... In bringing my name into this, he is unaware of this, but I can vouch for the materials that he's talking about because I did some experiments along these lines in 1988 when I had access to a lucrative dental plan when I was at MIT and was still able to do experimental work. I came across a paper on a new material that had come out. It was new in its presentation to me. You were talking about using it in 78. Now, that might have been a precursor to what I used, but... I saw the stress curves for it. In other words, it's compressive stress, it's strength, what you'd think of as just the strength of the material. And so I went to my dentist, and he had a little bit of the material, was aware of it. It was cured by light.
Yes.
So when you're using this material, say to fill, take a picture taking out a normal mercury amalgam metal filling and putting in the silicon dioxide material, it is a ground glass material in an epoxy. Yeah, polymer epoxy, that means a long chain molecule, and it is cured by using light. First of all, you needed to use ultraviolet light, which is actually good. You stick this ultraviolet light pipe down in the cavity in the tooth, and you end up killing a bunch of crap that you can't get out of the tooth by drilling and squirting and blowing air in and all that. So you actually do a lot of good by the very process of putting this material in. Furthermore, another elegant aspect of this that Dr. Carlson has talked about, but maybe... Well, I'll add a little bit to it. The teeth are part of a very important aspect of the energy field of the body. And each of the teeth have specific energies, or let's call them, in a sense, we covered material a while ago about little bugs and their little antennae and how they're picking up higher frequency energies. Well, the teeth, as well as the nasal cavity and other things, are actually tuned radiators and tuned receivers. So in the process of chewing food, you're also injecting energy into the food through the teeth. So when you have a material that's like normal tooth material, think of an antenna on your car, and all of a sudden in part of that antenna you stick in a piece of rubber in the middle of the antenna. Well, that's going to ruin the effective length of the antenna and how it radiates and how it receives. So the silicon dioxide material, the ground glass material, is much more equivalent in electromagnetic properties to the tooth than the metal materials. Therefore, it feels better in the tooth. For me, to put a rubber glove on my hand blocks the energy flows out of my hand terribly, or even to get them greasy. And I feel the same thing with any of the mercury amalgams that are in my teeth. So what we did was an experiment on about three of my molars, a very good process where they drill out the mercury amalgam and then put in this stuff in layers. And some of these teeth had deep fillings. And the damn mercury amalgams, of course, get pitted. And as a result, you get acidic crap forming underneath the filling and continuing to etch and decay the tooth. So you go to pull the mercury amalgam out, and you find quite a mess underneath the so-called thing that's supposed to be sealing the tooth. So you put in the, so now picture this. You drill that out. And if the tooth is not so bad that you lose all the sidewall, then you have a nice cavity which you inject light into, first of all, to cure it completely and kill whatever might be there, and then you put in a material that's very biocompatible. This silicon dioxide material is a very cool material to put in there. It's easier to work with, and it cures in layers. So if you have a big cavity to fill, you don't stick the whole thing in at once. You do it in layers and cure that with some light, then put another layer in, hit it with light again. So it's kind of like building up a layer of mortar on bricks. And yet, look at what you're doing. You're healing the tooth in the very process of putting this material in. Then the thing that my dentist was most concerned about was he was not as skilled at translating the materials properties data And as you say, you're so trained. Even though he was willing to be flexible, he was so trained in, well, mercury amalgams are the only thing that's strong. Well, these are molars, and they were only specifying this material for front teeth, for cosmetic purposes. And yet I said, no, I looked at the data, and I said, no, this is going to be stronger than a mercury amalgam. I don't care what they tell you in dental school. And so he put it in my molars, and now here it is 8 years later, and it's fine material. In fact, I would like to do it to others, except that, you know, you have to have a dental plan to afford it.
We have a dental plan.
But right now I can testify that this is, I've been talking on and off to people about this ground glass, this silicon dioxide material. Silicon dioxide basically is the same thing that you use for integrated circuits. If you think of a chip, an IC chip, this is just a little lesson in silicon dioxide. Yes, it is sand. And one of my cohorts from Stanford in the old days was from Egypt. And I'll just tell you this on him as a little aside, a very beautiful person from Egypt. And he was here at Stanford working on silicon dioxide in our integrated circuits laboratory. And he was trying to explain to his mother what he was working on. She's back in Egypt. And he says, well, Mom, it's like sand. So she paused for a minute and said, you mean you had to go all the way over to the United States? When right here in Egypt, we have tons of sand. So it gets lost in the translation to call it sand. But silicon dioxide is a very important material. That's why it is central. Next to silicon, it is the most important material along with gold that is used for making IC chips. It's the primary method that we use to insulate things on a chip. Think of a bunch of wires with no insulation on them. You have to have some way to insulate signals and electrical currents one from another. And silicon dioxide is a very elegant way that you form an insulator by causing a reaction between the silicon itself that you're using for a circuit and oxygen in the air, which just forms a silicon dioxide layer. But they make this stuff up by essentially grinding up glass. And it's in a polymer form, meaning it's kind of like putting varnish on something. That's what you suspend the particles in of the glass. So I just wanted to add that because I know Ron would be unaware that I have that in my mouth as a living experiment.
Thank you for that, Ed. I appreciate that because that validates and verifies to a great degree the strength of the material, because that's what I had found. I hadn't gone back to the old textbooks to look at the strength of these materials, although I knew that what I saw happening is that they were lasting. They weren't doing what I had been told they would be doing. But I did actually know the crushing strength and the tensile force and the rupture forces of them, but I just hadn't quite gotten to the place where everything was gelling. And in the paper that I sent Commander, it has the specifications from one of the most recent dental materials, and it shows the crushing strength of the silica polymer at 58,000 pounds per square inch, which is about, I think, around 300 pounds per square inch greater than your normal enamel. So if they tell you it's not strong enough in terms of crush strength, you're being led along a different path. Also, the tensile forces and the adhesion forces to the enamel, if the enamel's properly cleaned and treated, you can't break that stuff because the normal forces of mastication, your normal biting force is about 130 pounds at the first molar, and this stuff won't separate. I think it takes about 3,000 pounds to separate the material, small piece of material, from the enamel. At least that's one of the specs and one of the faces. So anyway, that's all I really needed to, I think, say, unless there's some questions, or maybe Melissa has something to add, because Melissa she is just getting her degree in acupuncture, and we were just in San Francisco. She's taking her final test, and the teeth are related electromagnetically, or at least according to the theory of acupuncture, to the meridians. And when you have disturbances, metallic substances, or endodontically treated teeth, or implants, you're according to Vol and according to my own experience, you're disrupting that normal balance. You just can't bring your body back into balance. I mean, your body can't do what I think God designed it originally to do, and that's live in perfect balanced rhythmic interchange with all substances. So,
can bridges be made out of that?
Yes.
And
this
crowns also.
I've been now. I've been for years building the teeth up. I would have normally crowned or capped a tooth, a cap or a crown or a jacket. Those words, caps, crowns, jackets, are basically the same thing. They mean going around the tooth, the entire tooth. When we do a filling, we cut part of the tooth apart, and we leave, as Ed said, a wall, a plate, on the cheek side, tongue side, or the middle or back side, and then we fill the tooth. We rely on the metal material, amalgam, which is made of mercury, basically, and silver and copper, tin and zinc, relies on an undercut or a mechanical locking into the tooth. There's no seal that's created. The only seal that's created, and it's one in which is not a true seal, and I don't know if there is such a thing as a true seal in the sense of a hermetic seal, is from corrosion. So when you take a filling out and you look underneath it, you see this. I mean, like Ed said, it's just it's a real not good thing to look at a lot of times. I mean, it's confusing for a dentist. I mean, if you see this video and you see the tooth that's removed, you'll see how black it is. And that had been in there for some 50 years. And that's what teeth do not look like that. Normal human teeth have a real nice yellowish, whitish tinge. It's called ivorine color. But going into the crown, going back to the crowns, yes, you can take, and rather than take all the filling out and then shape the tooth into a little peg, you can build the composite up, maintaining those walls, those plates, and it binds the tooth together. And they have done work on the strength. Actually, a tooth that in laboratories they have shown the crushing strength of the tooth is enhanced by about 20%. In other words, resistance to breakage is enhanced by putting the composite in, because the composite literally fuses to the enamel through a mechanical chemical interface, and it binds the tooth together much more strongly. And so you don't have to cap a lot of teeth. Like I do, I do about 70% fewer crowns in my practice. I just simply remove the amalgam, shape the tooth in a certain way that I've learned to do it, and that anyone can do, really. It's basic carpentry. I'm serious. Dentists are very, you know, highly paid carpenters and architects and engineers, although we don't know much about engineering. But we're also sanitation engineers. And that's not disrespectful. Sanitation engineers are people who pick up garbage and take care of the home. They're very important human beings. The point I'm trying to get to is that once you have taken that material out, you can just bind it together, and that keeps you from cutting the tooth further, more trauma to the tooth.
What about teeth that have already been capped?
Right, you've got just because I need a new bridge.
I've taken the crowns off. I've had some people come to me, and I just had a gentleman come. He had two gold crowns on, and we replaced his amalgams years ago, and I did one of the cantilever composite bridges, and that's working fine for him. Not years ago, about a year and a half ago. And he was having still, he's a real healthy young man, engineer, and he had still two problems in his bowel that, according to the workers, the naturopathic physician, the chiropractor, that he just had like little glitches. It was constipation. And he suspected it was his molar teeth, his lower molars, which sit on that meridian. So I simply took out the old gold crowns. We looked underneath and we made the decision the teeth are still viable, they're still restorable, they didn't look too bad. And it's like pouring concrete. I put a band around the tooth, wedge it with a couple of little wedges, batter boards, and I start, like Ed said, it's very meticulous though. You can't skimp on that. You have to layer it in. It's like building a good layered floor or a boat. And as you layer it, it's just awesome stuff to work with. It's a lot of fun for me. It's artsy, craftsy, and I enjoy doing it. Yeah, you have to cure. It's with a light. It's a wavelength of halogen, or an iodine wavelength, they say. That's the most appropriate wavelength of the visible light to cure the material. It polymerizes it. It makes it hard. And it comes in a little enclosed capsule. And if you were to leave it out in the sunlight, it would eventually cure. It would become hard. But it might take a day or maybe several hours. Whereas if you put this light right next to it and you cure it, it just, you know.
How long does it take to cure with the light?
Yes, about, we're advised to cure with a very strong, a good light, which they've improved on those greatly in over the last 15, 20 years. We cure for about 20 seconds each layer. So I'm very careful because you don't want to make an error. You'd rather, I don't know if overcure, but you can't. There's a little bit of heat generated, not much though. And the teeth remain actually quite sensitive for a longer period of time after you've replaced the amalgam. That's what I call normal, because you've taken away the material that's causing an overcharge of the tooth and deadens it. I call it endeadening the tooth when you have metal in your teeth. Now the teeth can breathe or live again or respond normally. Plus there's a torque, there's a coefficient of thermal contraction or expansion, depending on the light and the amount of material, and it will actually torque the tooth a bit. And teeth are hollow. The dentine of the teeth, underneath the enamel sheath, have billions and billions of little tubes running through them. It's a living substance. This is not just, you know, everything is living, but this is a little bit more living because you can feel it, right? So when you get down to the dentin, you torque it, and the teeth remember that a little bit more, and they have to adjust to it. So you have to be cautious in your chewing and, you know, your care of it. You don't want to overstimulate it thermally because the dentist has already cut the material out at high speed, and with water, without water, it can overheat and cause transient inflammation inside the tooth. Every tooth is a living organ. At least that's what I have come to understand, and needs to be approached with honor and respect. Yes, sir.
I've had Dicor crowns fail. How does this material compare with Dicor?
Dicor is Corningware. It is a glass substance. It's similar to what I believe maybe Ed would be more. It does not have a polymer, though. Dicor came out in the 80s as the first time I ever heard of Corningware crowns. That's when I started as part of the research project on that. But the difficulty with Dicor is made in a laboratory. An impression has to be taken. First off, the tooth has to be shaped. And when you're doing a Dicor, you have to do it much more radically. You have to take off more enamel thickness and more dentin than normally if you were to do a gold crown or a porcelain fused to gold crown. So Dicor is it's a very great, it's strong, it won't break unless maybe yours broke. Well, more than likely they didn't get the adequate thickness. And there's again, the composite, you have to have a certain amount of thickness, but my experience is not nearly as thick as what you'd have to do with a Dicor.
Right. In 1980, when I worked in a dental office, and they were just coming out with the composites, and is what they were finding through all of their research was the composites were not yellowing with age like the natural tooth would. So people were coming, they hadn't even really been long in the dental office. This was still in mostly the research stage. They were having to drill those out. Now, that's not a problem that you know of?
You mean that the material wouldn't yellow?
The material was not yellowing like the natural tooth yellows.
Right. No, this material, the composite picks up actually the color of the tooth. There are about three shades that you can use. And if there's enough of the tooth substance, all of a sudden you'll find it. You'll use a color that if you were to hold it in another area, it would look contrary to the shade of the person. But it's almost like a chameleon effect. So it does pick it up. Yes, you get
it? It is exactly.
It is?
It is exactly that. It will pick up the frequency, and every frequency has a color. And you have replaced a dead thing with basically a living thing. And it will take on your own frequency.
So for a lot of us who have interplays with our own dentists, and I can look on my x-rays and see these shiny little posts in various places, those should be removed and replaced with silicone dioxide? Or what should we do with that? And do our dentists have access to that, or should they interplay with you?
A lot of questions. It's probably best not to tell the dentist what to do. They don't like that. You know, arrogance abounds in my profession. Yes, Dr. No. But I would say that somebody was asking me for some guidance. I don't know the best way to find a biological dentist or a person who's committed first to the biological aspect. But there is a guy by the name of Ed Arana down in Carmel that I have met a couple of times, and I liked him, and he's on the forefront of many of these things, and he might be able to find people in this area or this in other areas that are the kind of people that you'd want to go to. But I would think a naturopathic physician or a chiropractor would have more access to a dentist who might be inclined to be more biological in approach than technical or metallic.
Who do you know here?
I don't know anyone here. That's what I said. Ed Aron is the closest person that I know of up in Carmel.
Well, now I think you could be a little more creative than that. How about 6 months here and 6 months in Paris?
Well, you know, Commander, that would be a great possibility. I just, you know, when I graduated from Michigan, I didn't, for some reason in those days, if you were in the upper third of your class, not intellectually, I mean mechanically, I was a good mechanic, not too hot in school, but I didn't have to take the dental boards in Michigan, so I just kind of drifted through the three-day examination. But when I went out to Hawaii, I took a board, a dental examination, and that's kind of like going through the trial by fire. And I hear California's even worse. I don't know, but I've always, I swore that I would never take another examination. So maybe we could do this, you know, midnight dentistry thing here. I don't know. Yeah.
Here. Your name was Jackson, right?
Right. Let's not get too hard on Mr. Jackson. That's a sensitive subject with Dr. Carlson.
Yes.
So when we're through with teeth, we'll talk about Jackson.
We're all going to be better materials engineers at the end of this discussion, because everybody gets interested when it's their teeth, as opposed to something in a textbook.
Haven't you noticed that is always true? When it can relate to you, exactly. You perk up.
So the one question about that, the Corning material, is it has to be shaped, as Dr. Carlson was saying, which it's a glassy material, but it is not composed of fine particulate in what you could think of as a liquid before it forms its pattern in a tooth. So as a result of the cutting and grinding and things that you do when you fit a crown and make it match with the one above it that it's grinding against, you inadvertently, or they neglect to tell you that, certainly not in medical school or in dental school, and certainly in materials research, you would automatically realize that when you start cutting into that material, you form the same thing that happens in glass as if you take a diamond ring and scratch it across this pane of glass here. You start to cut what are called dislocation boundaries and other abnormalities into the material, which will then propagate in the material. Just as if, how do you cut a piece of glass? You score it with a diamond scribe, and then you break it, and it breaks along that scribe mark. Okay. So my thought would be that the reason that the thing broke on you is because somehow it got scored, and as you keep chewing on it, the score mark propagates further and further into the material until it broke. And that would be a function of thickness, on the one hand. On the other, it's just maybe a little bit of overly ambitious grinding, because the original crown wasn't fitting quite right, or something like that. So, which would cause you to not only make it thinner to make it fit, shall we say, but every time you're grinding it, you're cutting more of these dislocation opportunities into the piece of glass. So that's that. Now, the other one has to do with this. You've got to understand how these polymers work. It's very simple. Polymers are just long chain molecules, organic molecules, and what happens when you put the light on them above a certain wavelength, the higher the frequency of the light, the more energy in the light, and what you end up doing is breaking a polymer chain. So think of something that's made up of one long rubber band versus something where the rubber bands are all cut into little pieces and they start knotting together, and that's called cross-linking. So when the photons of light are above a certain energy, it breaks the bonds of these long polymer chains, so it'd be kind of like taking string and cutting it into a bunch of little pieces and then rolling it all up. Well, it starts to bond together and bind together and cross-link and self-weave, if you can picture that. So that's what the light is needed for, and it doesn't take very long at all, 15 or 20 seconds, depending on the layer thickness, because it only takes a few instants. In any 1 second of light coming out of that light pipe that you use, it looks like a little light pipe that you use over the tooth, in any 1 second, enough photons of light have come out of that light pipe to use conventional modeling of light. So we don't get into a whole discussion of light particle versus wave and all that. Or we'll be here all afternoon.
Hey, whose meeting is it?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't intend to do this much talking. Anyway, so the cross-linking is what happens. So you have a picture of these tiny little glass particles. They're suspended in this kind of a liquidy goo, kind of like varnish. Picture it as varnish, if you want, for a good way to look at it. And that varnish is cured, cured meaning these little polymers that are part of the goo cross-link. As you apply the light. So it takes very little time. And if you hold the light on longer, only thing that's going to happen. As you hold the light on, the only thing that's going to happen is that you're going to help to cause more of the polymer to break up, which is only going to make it stronger and, shall we say, form around the little glass particles better. And the bonding to the tooth, as Ron was saying, is very important. And see what happens with the metals. They're so dissimilar. Think of chomping on an ice cube. Okay, well, when you put that ice cube in your mouth, you've got a metal feeling and a piece of enamel. Well, the coefficients of expansion and contraction, how much the metal expands and contracts versus the tooth, are very dissimilar. So even if you had a really nicely put in metal filling that was only 2 weeks old, guess what you're going to do the first time you chomp on that ice cube? Oh. You're going to pull the metal filling away from the tooth. So from that point onward, everything else you're eating is getting oozed down there in between the tooth and getting a nice, cold, wet, well, no, warm and wet, a damp, you know, environment to incubate all kinds of little critters that aren't very good for you. So if you pull the filling out, no wonder it looks black underneath it. And look at it now from an electrical point of view. You look what you've done to this little antenna, this little radiator of energy that's sitting in your mouth. Not only have you got materials in there that block the flow of those energies, but now you've added a layer of biological contaminants. Now remember what Commander's talked about, how we can send bugs and illnesses over high frequency. Well, let me see. I want to use the word scalar, or I'll get into another subject. But we'll just say body energies, high frequency energy. So if you want to picture this even worse, think of the tooth now being able to radiate frequencies that are not just what you want to come out of the tooth, but now you've got little biological, ugly biological invaders whose energies are being mixed with what you're trying to radiate out of the tooth. Now this is looking at things from an etheric point of view.
And then so, add aluminum foil.
Well, I usually unwrap my ho-hos before I eat them, so, and my baked potatoes.
So. But his real weakness is ketchup.
Uh-oh, then don't give away that. Now, I got something, I want to share something else with you while we're into science here. Somebody gave me this, one of our eagle-eyed readers gave me this on the 8th of March, and I'm only now getting around to looking at it. But this is the damnedest thing I've seen in a long time. I'm going to read this. It's about a new particle that some scientists discovered. This is from the April 96 edition of Discover magazine. And if it weren't written the way it is, I would call it an April Fool's joke. But let me just read this, because I don't know quite what to make of it. But there are strange things in this world. This says, it's called the Bigon, B-I-G-O-N. It's the name of a particle. You know, in particle physics, you've got all these little particles, you know, the mesons and electrons and photons and protons and all these little things. Well, this is called the Bigon. It says, Albert Mankey is a physicist of the old school. 50 years ago, physicists could make experiments using materials from the hardware store, says Mankey, who works at the Center of Study of Choices, something or other, in Paris. Got a long French name. I, too, prefer to work on a small scale. His penchant for tabletop research recently paid off. He and a colleague at the center have discovered an extraordinary new fundamental particle. Although the particle exists for just millionths of a second, it is the size of a bowling ball. Its existence, says Mankey, could possibly explain a host of mysterious phenomena. Yeah. Mankey and his colleague... Well, listen, this is not tongue-in-cheek. I'm just going to read this.
Everything from comets to you name it.
Yeah, right. Mankey and his colleague called a new particle a Bigon, and say its discovery was serendipitous. Their main research consists of building better vacuum tubes to replace microchips. We are the only physicists in the world working on that, more or less, says Mankey. Now, I'm going to stop there for a second because that's actually an important field. When microchips came along, I see chips in that. Vacuum tubes, as you well know, went out the window. But there are still some very important uses for vacuum tubes, and very interesting phenomena occur in vacuum tubes. And the certain people way up the ladder in high places would just assume that you don't know that vacuum tubes are useful. Now, when I was at MIT, one of my things I was working on off the record was with another person there, and we were making vacuum tubes on a chip. Way to replace normal vacuum tubes with filaments with solid-state versions of vacuum tubes. And I won't get into that, but it used diamond and diamond films. And because I happen to have a fondness for vacuum tubes, too. And back at my mother's house, I still have several old radios, vacuum tube radios, and I still think that vacuum tube amplifiers, power amplifiers for audio and hi-fi sound better. And I can tell you why, but we won't get into that either today. Now, to finish this, they said they were running a large current through one of their tubes when the monitor of a nearby desktop computer exploded. We thought it was an accident completely out of the blue. The computer was connected to an entirely separate electrical circuit, so it should not have been affected. that after we bought a new one and ran current again through the tube, the new computer, it too exploded. The physicist set up a video camera and repeated the experiment with the same explosive results. In one of the video frames, a black bowling ball-sized object hovered above the wreckage of the computer. In the next frame, it was gone. The researchers believe that the electric field in the vacuum tube somehow entered the energy state of the vacuum inside the cathode ray tube, blah, blah, and it goes on from here. But, and I'm not going to read the rest of the article, but there's a picture here of this big thing, and they also have put together a cloud chamber. Those of you who might know what a cloud chamber is, it's a kind of like a frosted piece of window glass that you put near your particles, and you can see their tracks in it. It's what particle physicists do to look at these small objects. They make these little curlicue tracks across the screen, and that's how you tell one microscopic particle from another. Well, when this big particle comes across the screen, it wipes out a whole third of the bubble chamber of the screen of the particle chamber. So, and here's a picture of this bowling ball thing going through one of the screens, the computer screen. Now, again, I'm cautioning because I see nothing here. It's in a section called breakthroughs in physics. I see nothing here. Yeah, right. No pun intended. I see no reason that this is a April Fool's Day joke. I'm aware of the importance of the vacuum tubes that were used in the Montauk project. For those of you who remember Al Bielek's work, whether he's remembering it properly or not in his present mode of mental, what he can recall. But I just thought I would share this because one of our eagle-eyed readers gave this to me a couple weeks ago saying, what do you think they found? Well, I don't know. I would put Commander on the hot spot if he wants to, but it's an odd thing for me to talk about.
Well, they've isolated or come across the very thing that makes an opening between time continuums.
Yes. Which is would be like the Montauk Project.
Yes, exactly.
Well, if 32 frames a second, if it only blinks for a minute, they were plenty lucky to get it on the film.
Must
have been time to do it.
Whatever, Princeton. Shall we take a break? This is getting out of control. The rest of the day will be fun, though, because we could talk about such wondrous things as vacuum tubes and comets that appear out of nowhere with Japanese names and dissolve into nowhere, stick around for many nights for you to go peer at, and then suddenly it begins to fade. Well, the light goes out eventually, but it's still in the same place. And then suddenly, I guess it's gone to come back in 20,000 years. Oh, quit believing this garbage. Look around. It's time for all sorts of wonderful things to begin to bloom and blossom. And there are wonderful products out there, and these are the things that you have to move on into utilization. You can take some of this bonding material and these composites, these silicates. They are the foundation of programming. They become the program for the living product or living molecules. What did you call this? Polymer. You see, these are the wondrous things that can be pumped down old pumper wells that have dried up, where the oil is seeped out into the ground, and these polymers will pull in that oil. It will pull it. Polymer cleaners can be put into smokestacks. You don't have to live in a polluted world. You could still use the same things that you use and clean it up. But that's not allowed to you. These are the ultimate weapons to be used against you. So you're stuck with what is. On the other hand, you have to begin to grow now and dare to reach out. It becomes really easy to quit. because as they throw the rocks get bigger and bigger and bigger. On the other hand, pretty soon they can't lift the rocks, and they're going to fall back on themselves and smash. It takes the brave few who dare just to take a stand. And for those ones, you're going to get plenty of protection. Dorma says, well, I'd prefer you protect me out of jail than in jail. Well, I'd prefer it be that way, too. But we have to have a little experience and a little fun along the way. And what you perceive as fun may be what I perceive as a necessary experience or example. So we can't even really mesh there. But you've got some serious, serious things coming up, because there were some of these Mobutu-type Ebola mutants that hit in Arkansas, actually. Those patients die, and you never hear any more about it. A statement's made that they've got some hemorrhagic disease in Arkansas with visitors to tracks and so forth, races, whatever their excuse will be. It will be something different at the Georgia Olympics. But patients die and go away, and it's easily covered up. And I don't know, maybe later or even in a few minutes, you might want to watch the first part of this motion picture outbreak. I asked Dorma to bring it so you can share it. You can pick it up anywhere. You can rent it or purchase it. I believe at Costco it was less than $5 or $6 or something like that. It's worth it to have. Every time you get careless, go look at it. And this is absolute truth. This is absolute truth. This is exactly the way the government handles several village outbreaks. Just blew the village away. So if anybody wants to use this, if we don't get to it, fine. I want to share this one. This came from...